From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Fort Lauderdale, Florida. South Florida woman says that she peeked inside an SUV with a stack of parking citations on the windshield and saw the body of a man slumped over the center console. Carolyn White says that she wonders why a parking meter attendant did not see the 62-year-old Jacob Morpe. He was inside the vehicle when the citations were written. Listen to this. From November 12th to November 15th, the day the body was found. The guy was in there for 3-4 days, and they kept putting tickets on the windshield. The newspaper reports, by the way, out that way, that the city has dismissed the parking tickets. Unbelievable. Four major cities moved to ban diesel vehicles by 2025. The mayors of Paris, Mexico City, Madrid, and Athens say they are implementing the ban to improve air quality there. I hope they know what they're getting into. Trucks use diesel fuel. President-elect Donald Trump supporters are moving to block election recount efforts in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. The legal motions are designed to halt Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein's request for a ballot review. Nearly 2,000 Iraqi troops have been killed across Iraq in the month of November, according to the newly released UN figures, as they battle forces of ISIS all around the country. 2,000 Iraqi troops. Doesn't look like they're winning at all. Let's check in with Jerome Corsi from WND.com, of course. Jerry, this problem with ISIS seems to be growing in Iraq.
Well, ISIS is still a very strong force in Iraq. And coming out of Aleppo, where more and more people are going to be refugees, I think the problem throughout the region of ISIS is yet to be contained. I don't see really any solution to it at the present time. And it's going to be very interesting to see what President-to-be Trump does when he gets into office, because I think it's going to take a strong military solution, maybe even with the cooperation of Russia, in order to really defeat or contain ISIS in the region.
Jerry, the Electoral College meets in a couple weeks. Do you see any hanky-panky going on, any problems?
Not really. I think, basically, George, these recounts, I think, are going to produce minimal changes in the states like Wisconsin. After one day, one vote was changed in favor of Hillary Clinton. I don't think the recounts are going to produce any meaningful result because there's no basis for a real suspicion that there was fraud. I mean, if you recall the Florida recount in 2000, George, there was problems with the ballot.
That's right.
And there were real problems with people being confused and marking the ballot incorrectly. That did produce errors. There's no similar kind of systematic error in the states that are being recounted, so I don't expect any fundamental change. I think the Electoral College will go forward, and Donald Trump will be the president.
Jerry, have yourself a good weekend. Thank you. The U.S. economy added 178,000 net new jobs last month, just above consensus expectations of 176,000 jobs. But everybody is saying this could mean interest rates will rise. A Manhattan man who lost his sight nearly 20 years ago has regained his vision. He went blind in 1997. He has now regained most of his sight. Kevin Coughlin of Murray Hill was blinded by an optic nerve disease at the age of 36. Doctors are totally baffled why his sight has come back. That's a great story. An unmanned Russian spacecraft bringing 2.5 tons of supplies to the International Space Station was lost shortly after liftoff from Kazakhstan. According to reports, it may have blown up in the atmosphere. What else is going on up there? Let's check in with Peter Tavenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Peter, welcome back.
Thank you, George. It's been a while since I've done one of these updates. I'm delighted to be back. Between your travel schedule and mine and a holiday, it sort of conspired to keep me off the air, but I'm delighted to be here because over the last 3 weeks or so, I think my last presentation was on Veterans Day, the 11th of November, our center has received between 400 and 500 new reports, some of them really, really intriguing. And I've got about five that I'd like to present to our audience tonight.
Sure.
The first two are about as close to Independence Day type sightings as I've handled recently. I talked to the gentleman who submitted this first report I'm going to talk about from North Platte, Nebraska. This comes to us from August of 1985, so this is 31 years ago. He was working in he bills it as the largest rail classification yard in the world, apparently one of those yards where they assemble these 100 or 200 car trains that you always encounter when you try to cross a railroad track. But he was in his shack on one edge of this field. He estimates that the yard is about a mile and a quarter or a mile and a half long. And suddenly his boss, the yardmaster, started yelling over the PA system for everybody to go outside. He went out and he saw a gigantic rectangular object hovering above the yard, George. And he says that the yard, the ground on which he was standing as he looked at this thing, was trembling underneath his feet. Here's the type of thing that really confuses me. This all happened 31 years ago. I talked to this gentleman tonight before the program. I wanted to be sure it was a serious report. He's very eloquent, a constant, regular Coast listener. He's probably listening tonight. But I was very impressed with what he had to say, and it's really an intriguing report. We should have it posted to our website this weekend, but North Platte, Nebraska, August of 1985, makes me wonder how many other reports there are out there, equally dramatic sightings that people simply haven't reported, haven't written down. Second report comes from the 11th of November, 3 weeks ago tonight. Young woman, she's a public servant, has a very responsible job in Greeley, Colorado. She reports at 11:46 a.m. on that Friday, again, the 11th of November this year, she was out in her yard playing with her children, and suddenly the dog started barking. A car that was driving down the nearby road suddenly stopped. Apparently the engine stopped for some reason that may or may not be related to the incident. And suddenly the ground and her house, the windows in her house, started rattling. They looked up and saw a gigantic round object moving across the sky. Sighting lasted only 2 or 3 minutes, she writes. And her kids were shocked by it.
They ran inside.
Very, very interesting sighting. They saw a big disc or spherical object passing across the sky, and it was being chased, she writes, by two jet fighters. Very eloquent writer. I suspect she's an excellent witness and a highly reliable report. Next report comes from Fairfield, California, up northeast of San Francisco. That's the hometown of Travis Air Force Base. 3 nights ago, a gentleman writes, he was outside and he was having a smoke after he'd been watching some aircraft over Travis make steep descents into that airport. He suddenly saw what at first he took to be a V-shaped formation of migratory birds. Equally quickly, he realized they were not birds at all, but it was a solid object that was eclipsing the stars as it moved across the night sky. Very large boomerang or V-shaped object moving slowly over Travis Air Force Base to the east. I have no idea what it was, but a really nicely prepared report. Again, we'll have all these reports posted over this upcoming weekend. Last night, Plainville, Connecticut, near Hartford, Connecticut, gentleman was sitting in his car waiting to pick up his daughter from work, and he saw an orange-pink light coming at him. He knew immediately that it was not an aircraft, something very unusual. He saw a second one, really an interesting report, and I mention it only because something very similar was reported from Wisconsin tonight by a group of 12-year-olds who were playing soccer on a soccer field there. We'll have these posted. People can read them to their own satisfaction. And finally, last report comes down from your area, or comes from down your way, George.
Mm-hmm.
A gentleman and his two younger brothers were standing outside near Pasadena, he reported over the telephone. We have yet to get his written report, but he pledged he would submit one. They saw a cluster of about 24, he estimates, sparkling, twinkling objects coming from the southwest, I think he said. They stopped directly above the three of them and sat there. More of them continued to join this primary group of twinkling objects. Suddenly, they all accelerated and flew off to the northeast. So you're right. There's a lot going on in the skies these days. We'll have about 500 reports posted to our website
Wow.
for the Coast Reading Pleasure by the end of the weekend.
Okay, great. Thanks, Peter. Always good talking to you. A Burmese python in the Florida Everglades with a desire for venison, that's deer, gulped down three whole deer, one doe, two fawns, before wildlife officials captured and euthanized it. Unbelievable story. Talking about unbelievable stories, up next we're going to be talking with Venom Doc. That's right. This is a person, well, I'll tell you about it when we come back. You won't believe the story. Venom Doc, that'll tell you what it is, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're going live down under to Australia to talk to someone who may have one of the world's most dangerous jobs. Brian Fry, born in 1970, to a Norwegian mother and an American father, educated in the United States, attended Portland State University. He's also the author of a couple books, Venom Doc, which we'll be talking about, and also the author of Venomous Reptiles and Their Toxins. He's an associate professor in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Queensland in Australia, where he is a group leader of the Venomics Laboratory. You're not going to believe this interview. Brian, welcome to the program, first of all, and I hope you are well.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, I'm all right. Just took some stitches out of my finger, but that's, you know, nothing.
Well, another snake bite?
No, this is cutting my finger to the bone while putting up a hammock last week
Oh.
in the field. But we started the same day, my best mate, Chris, bandaging me up with duct tape, and then finished the day with me bandaging him up with duct tape after he got bit by a venomous snake, and then we had a 5.5-hour dash across the desert to get him to the nearest hospital.
Oh, my God. Now, you've been bitten, what, 26 times at least?
Yeah, and it's no fun.
My God. Well, first of all, let's go back to the Brian Fry when he's a little boy. Were you interested in snakes and reptiles and creatures like that?
Very much so. When I was a kid, the first memory I have is being in a hospital bed, so not much has changed. And that's because when I was a two-year-old, I picked up spinal meningitis from the Fort Belvoir military base daycare there, when my dad was stationed in D.C. And I was a very sick little baby, and they had me restrained with my arms, legs, and head were restrained because I kept, like a little hairless monkey, pulling out all the tubes, including the ones they had implanted into my temples. And so that was my first, you know, flirtation with death. And then after that, I'd be looking to my mom's photo albums. She was the daughter of Norwegian diplomats, and so she grew up living in Africa and other places. And there are pictures of cobras in their garden, gudeen vipers on their tennis courts. They had a mamba in their house one time. And I just was entranced with these creatures, and then it synced with that early experience I have regarding toxins, where, you know, and then some magic happens and the rest of your life is on a completely different trajectory. So I was a very weird child. I'm a pretty weird adult, but I, you know, consider myself pretty happy. I reckon that if more people did follow their childhood dreams, the world would be a much weirder and nicer place.
Now, Brian, I got to tell you, and don't be mad at me, but I hate snakes. I hate snakes.
Well, flip this around. Do you know if you or someone you care about take high blood pressure medication?
My father did, God rest his soul, and I have a buddy who takes it.
Well, odds are that they're taking a class of compound that's actually derived from a snake toxin, that captopril and the other angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors are derived from South American lancehead viper venom, this was developed actually 40 years ago, remains today a $10 billion a year market.
Wow.
And it's up there in the top 20 drugs of all time, up there with things like aspirin. So this shows why the only good snake is actually a live snake.
Are there pharmaceutical companies who extract that for their medicine who have snake farms where they raise snakes just for that purpose?
Very much so, if they're harvesting the native form. And on the case of captopril, it's a synthetic version developed in the laboratory, so it no longer requires snakes. But if we wipe snakes out, then we can't discover these new wonder drugs. And it, you know, it's the broader idea of nature conservation in general, where when students ask me in the courses I teach, what's the strongest message to get conservation, you know, appreciated, I always say that your weakest message is to talk about how beautiful you find creature X, Y, or Z, or how amazing it is to go diving in the barrier reefs. These are all, of course, entirely true statements, but your far right Trump type people are not going to appreciate that argument. What they are going to appreciate is dollar signs. And so conservation through commercialization is the only viable way of getting people to want to conserve. That if you can show that this is a biobank, it's worth lots of money, but we can't make withdrawals if we've destroyed it. So therefore, chopping down all the forests in the national park is no different than popping a nuke on top of an oil field. You're destroying a vast economic resource.
Is the venom that you extract from a snake the same poison that the snake puts in you when they bite you?
Yeah, and it goes to that statement that any poison can be a medicine in an appropriate dose, or conversely, any medicine can be a poison.
All right.
And we have a long history of using natural products this way, where 70 to 80% of our current medications are actually derivatives of plants. That these,
that's
a lot of
right.
These are compounds that plants have evolved to deter herbivores that are grazing on them, but we've figured out some unexpected side effects that make them useful as therapeutics.
What is it about the snake bite from the poisonous snake that can harm you, kill you? What is the compound that does that?
It's a myriad of things. Anything reachable by the blood is fair game for the evolution of a toxin within the venom of a snake or other venomous animals. So you have some that might cause you to throw a whole bunch of blood clots and you die of stroke. You have other ones that might cause you to have complete anticoagulation, where your blood is basically just red water, and you die of fun things like bleeding into your brain.
Right.
Or in case of one of the snake bites that I had that was near fatal, I bled out of my ass for 18 hours. Yeah, good times. Then you have some that keep your nerves from sending the message to contract a muscle, so you block that message from getting through, and those are the ones where you die of limp paralysis, you know, sedated, like an overdose of morphine kind of paralysis, versus those other ones, like the long-glanded coral snake that we published about a month ago to Global Viral Press, that causes the nerves to turn on, and you have a spastic paralysis, sort of like, you know, dying of methamphetamine. Basically, you're slamming the gas pedal to the floor of your body and cutting the brake line.
Now, you're a professor, right? You're a professor of biological mm-hmm. sciences, but the extracting of the venom, is that like a side job? What is that?
Well, that's the fun part. All my research is driven by this amazing love and wonderment that I have for these creatures, and I find them so dear, and I want to just learn more about, you know, these animals that, you know, are, you know, my favorite kinds of creatures. You know, they're not everyone's cup of tea, but what I derive the real enjoyment from is actually working with the animals. So if I, you know, didn't have the talent for chemistry that I have, I'd still be working with them in some capacity, like as a park ranger or something like that. I just happen to be very good at biochemistry, and so I was able to pursue my interest in the venom side of it, of this, you know, incredible, the ultimate smart weapons, and how can we use that to develop new medications, which will then in turn can, you know, encourage people to want to conserve the animals that are typically so demonized.
How much venom do you get out of a snake at any given time?
It really varies. Some of them, like some of the sea snakes, will give you tiny amounts, like only maybe, say, a couple milligrams. Other ones, like the Australian king brown snake, can actually give up to a gram and a half of venom in a single milking, far more than like a king cobra or even big snakes like the American eastern diamondback rattlesnake. But of course, quantity is only but one factor. There's also the speed of action and how potent it is. Like a cobra, for example, will give you a lot less venom than a rattlesnake, but it's comparably more toxic.
So hold on, Brian. We're going to take this commercial break, but we're going to come right back and talk more. I'm with the Venom Doc tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Brian Fry, our special guest tonight, as we talk about his book, Venom Doc, the edgiest, darkest, strangest natural history memoir ever. And it is. We're going to get to him about some stories, too. He's been stung by poisonous snakes 26 times, at least 26 times. And welcome back to Coast, Brian Fry with us here. We're talking about his work, Venom Doc. Jeez, it's a 24-hour job, Brian, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. Especially like at night when I let my dogs out, I have to go shine in the yard, make sure there's no snakes in the yard, and sometimes it's one that we need.
What is the deadliest snake on the planet?
Whichever one just bit you. otherwise, if we want to look at it a bit more academically, you have two factors to consider. One is, what is just the simple comparative toxicity, in which case it would be the Australian inland taipan. But otherwise, you have to compare, you have to keep in mind also the venom yield. So if one, let's say, one is twice as toxic as another, but that other one gives you 10 times as much, you're getting potentially five times the lethality put into you. So in that case, I would rate the deadliest snake in the world to be the Australian coastal taipan, because the inland taipan might take about a milligram to kill a person. Average yield might be 80 to 100 milligrams. Coastal taipan takes about 3 milligrams to kill a person, but the yield can be 750 milligrams
Wow.
or more. So you're getting potentially 250 times the amount that it would take to kill you is being injected in the average bite.
Brian, how soon does someone die or really they're in trouble when they get bit by a snake?
It varies because humans are just collateral damage. We are irrelevant from the perspective of these snakes evolving. And the snakes are evolving to kill their prey. That's the evolutionary selection pressure. So a bite to a human is just an inconsequential action from the perspective of a snake. And that's why snakes that feed on, that specialize on lizards, for example, may have a venom that's 100 times more potent to a lizard than to a mammal. Now, the ones that are the most dangerous to humans are the ones that feed on mammals because they're feeding on animals that are physiologically closer to us. And with some of these, the ones that kill by inducing stroke in the mammals are the ones that are going to kill a human the fastest. So the snakes that will kill you the quickest of any kind in the world are the Australian brown snakes, where deaths can result in 10 to 15 minutes versus
Jeez.
Something like an American rattlesnake. If you're unlucky enough to die from that, it could take 24 hours or longer.
Will a snake bite without provocation?
No. The snakes are biting us only because they're scared. They view us as a potential predator. We are far too large for them to be viewing us as anything that they might want to eat. So they're biting purely for defensive purposes. So it's not a snake attack. It's a snake defense.
So we stumble into the snake or we're in a nest or something, and that's when they lunge out at us.
Exactly. The bites are due to human provocation. And often it's deliberate provocation where you get people who try to kill a snake rather than just ringing the wildlife office to have someone come over and remove it. Obviously, you're not in any danger if you have enough time to go into your garage and get a shovel. Therefore, if you try to kill it, only injure it, it bites you in defense. You do not have the divine right to throw yourself to your knees, raise your arms to the heavens, and plaintively cry, "Why me?"
Oh, exactly. How far, Brian, can a snake lunge out?
With most of the snakes, they typically strike about half their body length at most. So if you have a 2-meter snake, it's going to be only able to strike typically about a meter. Of course, they can be fast and move forward, their body and then strike again. But it's not like they're going to be able to launch themselves through the air several times their body length and connect to your leg that way.
Do you have a few stories you'd like to share with us about these snakes?
Oh, where to begin?
I know.
Well, the snake bite itself, well, first off, it's the loneliest place on Earth. You can't imagine the feeling of what it's like to go through a snake bite. And I'll use two examples of very different extremes. One was the time I was bitten by a Stevens Bandit snake in the rainforest outside of Brisbane. And this is a snake that kills by disrupting the blood of its prey. So in this case, it turned my blood into red water.
Oh, my God.
The first sign that something was not going to be going my way was I started bleeding out of my eyes. It was like the coolest form of stigmata ever. It was terrifying in a really cool way. And then I started bleeding out of my mouth, and then I started bleeding out of my butt. And I'm absolutely terrified at this point because I'm at severe risk of bleeding inside.
You're literally, you're dying.
And if I'm unlucky enough to survive, I could have permanent disability. You know, last thing you want is to bleed into your brain and actually survive. You're going to be a vegetable. It's like aiming a hose at a big pile of dirt. You're going to have a physical erosion.
Oh, my God.
It's going to produce wildly unpredictable effects. And there was a high-profile case here in Australia over the last month or two where a young boy was bitten by a taipan, ended up bleeding in his brain, and now he survived, but he has severe permanent disability.
That sparkly
young boy is no longer. He's looking at you with flat, dead eyes. Now, he's no longer inside. And now an opposite extreme of a bite was when I got bit by a Pilbara death adder, a very rare type of death adder in the Western Australian region. And this produced an incredible neurotoxic effect where it felt like a massive DMT trip, where I was completely paralyzed for about a day. But from my perspective, I was drifting through time and space for eons. And it felt like hundreds of thousands of years. And I feel like I'm the oldest person alive because it really warped my perception of time so profoundly that, you know, time became meaningless. So it's a good example of just the wildly disparate effects that snakes can have on you. I mean, you could die screaming or you could die smiling.
Did these bites occur when you were trying to extract venom or just out there?
One was when we were capturing it, and the other was when I was doing a venom extraction and things went wrong. You know, we're working with inherently dangerous animals that are actively trying to defend themselves. And if they have a slightly better day than we do, then my day could go really, really badly. I have to succeed every time. They only have to succeed once.
Well, that's right. And hopefully you've always been with somebody when you get bitten?
Yeah, when we're out in the field or when we're working with them in captivity, we have a rule of working with them in pairs because the snake bite effects cannot be very quick, but as can any allergy. That people who work around venomous snakes and their venom for extensive periods of time often develop an allergy to the venom itself and therefore can go into allergic shock from the bite, much like someone who's allergic to bees. And this actually happened last week with my best mate, Chris. He went into allergic shock after he was bit by a mulga snake when we were deep in the desert. And, we had to treat him on the way to the hospital with emergency injections in order to keep him alive. And allergic shock is, in a lot of ways, even worse than going through a snake bite. It is just the most singularly awful feeling you can imagine. Imagine all your skin being sandblasted off from the inside. That's what it feels like.
I'm looking at the cover of your book, Venom Doc, and there you are holding what kind of snake, which is only like 2 inches away from your face.
So that particular snake on the cover of the book is a 4.5 meter, 13 or 14 foot king cobra in Singapore.
Jeez. Now, why do you have it so close to your face?
Well, I'm holding it, so it's safely restrained. It can't get to my face.
Yeah, but his tongue alone could hit you in the eye.
Oh, that's all right. You know, that can't do anything. There's no venom on the tongue. The venom's all from those little pointy teeth.
Well, can't his head lunge out at you?
No, because I've got him restrained.
Well, so I know that. So he can't move then. You're saying he's like
exactly
stuck.
Yeah.
Now, I bet he wants to bite you, though, doesn't he?
Of course, you know, because I'm violating his personal space. You know, he did not choose to, you know, embark upon this encounter.
My God. You enjoy this.
Well, yeah, it's fun, you know, partially because I'm an adrenaline junkie and also because I really like snakes. You know, I think that they're just amazing creatures. I don't know why. You know, it's just my predilection has always been in that direction. Some of them aesthetically are stunning. Like if you look up the blue long-landed coral snake that we're working on, it's got a bright red head and bright red tail, these electric blue stripes running the length of its body. It's a living piece of art.
I bet when you go out at some event or party and people ask you what you do, they're in shock once you tell them.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people that do this job. It's, you know, definitely one that happens to stand out a little.
So when you extract the venom from the snake, you're putting like something, some kind of a small beaker or something by their mouth, and I guess you have to put their fangs in there. What do you do?
Well, exactly. So we bring a small receptacle towards them. When we've got it restrained either by hand or its head's popping out of a restraining tube, whatever it may be. And then we put, you know, present the beaker to them, and quite often the snake will quite happily chew on it because it's pretty pissed off at that point. So they're usually quite willing to give the venom. So that's, once you have them restrained and you're at that stage of it, that's the easy part. You know, you've already gotten past the really dangerous part, which is the restraining of the snake to begin with.
How often does the snake regenerate its venom?
So when they feed in the wild, they typically will feed about once every month or two, which is fine from the perspective of venom regeneration because it takes them about 10 to 14 days to regenerate what venom they've used. But when they feed in the wild, they never deliver everything that they have. They meter it a bit, so they always have a bit held back.
Okay. All right. So they can attack again and again if they had to.
Exactly. So if they opportunistically come across an abundance of prey, they can eat, you know, more than they may normally have been eating.
Brian,
for the drier, more famine times.
Generally, when a snake bites you, does it try to get away or does it keep coming at you?
Typically, they don't want anything to do with us. So they'll bite sometimes without even injecting venom. But they won't, and then retreat. It'll be very few snakes that will bite repeatedly, but that's one of the things that makes the Australian coastal taipan such a dangerous snake, is that it's one of the few that will bite repeatedly. And the reason for that is that this fits with their natural predatory behavior, because they feed on very, very dangerous prey animals in Australia that would normally be avoided by snakes because they can easily injure or even kill a snake. So things like bandicoots or the native Australian plague rat, very, very formidable prey. So the taipans are overwhelming them by striking repeatedly and delivering copious amounts of this incredible, you know, venom that is amazingly toxic. But that means that human bites, people are often double tapped or even more. Like there's one case in Australia where an 8-year-old boy was killed and the taipan bit him 12 times in just a few seconds.
Unbelievable. And I assume the bite itself must hurt like heck.
Not really. It's just, you know, puncture wound. So it's, you know, no different than just getting a, you know, a nail into your thigh or something like that. It's, you know, it's no big deal.
I don't know. I don't think I'd like a nail in my thigh.
Well, you know, compared to like a, you know, something larger like a stingray barb, where they can be a foot and a half long.
Yeah.
Some of the very large species. And remember the first time I got stung by a stingray, the barb went through into my thigh and all the way down to the bone. And when the spine came out, it was completely defleshed, you know, for about 6-8 inches, which meant I got a massive venom yield. And other than the first time that I broke my back, that was easily the most painful thing I've ever gone through. You know, stingray sounds so benign. Oh, it stings. No, it should be called the give me a gun so I can kill myself ray.
Isn't that what killed Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter?
Indeed it was. Now, stingrays use their venom only for defense. They've evolved it to defend against things like tiger sharks or killer whales. So it's an incredibly painful venom. People don't die from the venom, even though you may want to kill yourself. What people die from with stingray envenomations is mechanical damage. And in the case of Steve Irwin, he was struck in the chest and in the heart, which is not a coincidence because stingrays detect their prey, bivalves and snails and things like that in the sand by detecting their electrical signals. They're basically, think of them as a giant electrical receiving disc, incredibly sensitive to any electrical disturbance. If you take a stingray, cover its eyes in a laboratory setting, and bring an electrified object to it like the size of a tennis ball, it can hit it with pinpoint accuracy without even using its eyes. And of course, what is the most electrified part of our body? Our hide. And there have been other clinical cases of people being stung in the hide. So it was an unfortunate and terribly tragic event, but nevertheless, it was something that's very useful from a clinical teaching perspective.
I had interviewed Steve on the program, and then six to 12 months later, he was gone when we heard that story, and I just couldn't believe it, Brian. I mean, what a fluke way to go.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't the animal that, you know, people would have been leading with on the office betting pool as far as the one most likely to kill him.
That's right.
I'm sure people would have been putting their money more likely on crocodiles. So, yeah, it was a very, you know, like I said, it was a very aberrant event. But, it, you know, what was really, you know, one of the things that was horrible was afterwards that there was all these revenge killings of stingrays when this was an animal that was just trying to defend itself.
Yeah.
And if you leave a stingray alone, it'll leave you alone. And if you go to places like the Grand Cayman Islands, there's entire dive industries built around scuba diving with these animals because they're actually amazingly intelligent. And once they realize you're not a threat, they can actually be quite inquisitive.
What is worse, getting bitten by a venomous snake or stung by a scorpion?
Oh, scorpion. You know, that that was agony. I almost got killed by a scorpion in the Amazon. And first off, the pain is like putting your finger in a candle flame and leaving it there for about 8 hours. But the really freaky part was what it did to my heart rate, where my heart would beat about 90 to 100 beats in about 100 in only 30 seconds.
Oh, my God.
But then it would pause. It would stop for 5 or 6 seconds.
Oh.
And I'm about ready to pass out. Like, if you put someone in a chokehold and block the carotid artery, in 5 seconds, they're nearly passing
they're
out.
They're passed out.
Then my heart would accelerate again. For 30 seconds, stop, accelerate, stop, accelerate, and that went on for 6 hours. And it's really weird feeling.
You think you're going
to
die.
Your lungs.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm able to inflate my lungs. I'm able to do all that, but I've got no heart rate. It's a really unsettling.
Ready to pass out, then you revive. Ready to pass out, then you revive.
Yeah, it's just... Wow.
Now, do you have to wait for that scorpion poison to get out of your system? What do you do? Drink water? I mean, how do you do that?
Normally you would get antivenom, but we were in the middle of the Amazon. We were 36 hours from the nearest supply of antivenom. We were a six-hour walk just to get to where the first of our little boats was.
Oh, my God.
So all I had, there's nothing to do but just suffer through it.
How big was the scorpion, Brett?
Not terribly big. Maybe 3.5, 4 inches long.
Oh, that's not big at all.
Not a massive animal by any stretch of the imagination.
All right, stay with us, Brian. We're going to come back for the final hour with you and take some phone calls from people interested who might want to share some of their own strange animal bite stories as well, just to get your reaction. Brian Fry with us. His book is called Venom Doc, and it's available right now for you at Amazon.com.
Join the Coast to Coast AM Facebook page with thousands of members. It's great for show updates and connecting with other fans. Go to facebook.com/coasttocoastam and click the like button.